and we can turn it around. And again, I love interviewing people who are on the green front lines, turning it around in their own area of expertise. And one of the women who has been on the front lines for many years, at least I've been aware of her for as many years as I've been doing Green Radio, just about 10, 11 years now, is Julia Witte. She is a very witty writer and knowledgeable writer for Mother Jones, for Blue Marble. She's written several books. Her most recent just released a few days ago called Deep Blue Home, An Intimate Ecology of Our Wild Ocean. And she's written other books, including The Fragile Edge. So it is my pleasure and thrill, really, to have her as she begins her book tour on the West Coast, to have her here on the Green Front. Welcome, Julia.
Hi, Betsy.
And welcome back from the front lines on the Gulf Coast. Let's begin with that. What is it like down there? I had Ricky Ott on and Diane Wilson, other Shiros of mine a few weeks back, but I haven't had anyone, you know, in about 3 weeks who was down there very recently. So let's begin there, and then we'll dive deeper, so to speak.
Yeah, well, as you can imagine, the scene is pretty grim. It's pretty bleak. I mean, there's not really any good news coming out of it. I'm alarmed again today to see that they're slowing down this effort to put on the new cap. But on the other hand, if they do it wrong, things are going to get a lot worse. Hmm. The situation is really grim. I don't think we've faced anything like it. There isn't a true clear end in sight, so we're talking about enormous destruction to really a ecosystem, the Gulf of Mexico, that has already been under so much stress that I think it could potentially be doom for some parts of the ecosystem and some species.
And we hate to be all gloomy and doomy, but I remember when I had you on my program EcoTalk on Air America a few years ago, you had just written an alarming article for Mother Jones on the state of our oceans. And I remember feeling both depressed and inspired at the same time by what you found. And like you say, now things are kind of worse than ever. Will this finally, you know, be a turning point for the rest of America and the world to wake up to really understand and see the true costs of our addiction to oil and fossil fuels in general?
Well, I really hope so. I think this is our golden opportunity right now to really make those changes. Everyone I know, regardless of their connection to the ocean or not, are really deeply affected by this leak and this tragedy down there and the ongoing, you know, situation. And I think people are really, this may be the wake-up call that really gets people motivated to say, can this be the moment where we change from a really bad energy paradigm to a better one?
It better be, as you said. And, of course, our president has called for that transition, but didn't quite go far enough, many feel, in laying out the green print for that. But there's plenty of answers and solutions out there. We just have to really have, as Al Gore says, the political will to really make this happen. And if the political will and public will isn't there now or in the wake of this, once the oil stops gushing, perhaps people can then kind of stop and say, oh, my God, now what? Now that the, you know, fresh oil is not spewing the sea monster, as someone called it, let's really, you know, yes, start the cleanup in earnest, but also use this opportunity to say, where do we go from here?
Exactly. And I think it's not only an opportunity to look at our energy future and what kind of an energy future do we want. Now, we've really seen the true costs of cheap oil, and they're extremely untenably high. We can't afford the cost of this kind of fuel. So that's one opportunity. But the other thing that this tragedy is really presenting to us is a moment of maturity for us to finally look out to the ocean and say, you know, we have to really think about what we're doing out there. We're still taking it for granted. We're still ignoring it. We don't give any of our activities in the ocean nearly the level of examination that we give activities on land. We're still treating it like a poor relative that we're barely paying any attention to, and that clearly needs to change. What's going on in the Gulf right now is out of sight, but it will all wash ashore to affect us in so many ways, and I think maybe this tragedy will bring that more to life than it ever has before.
And what's going on in the oceans really is sort of a paradigm for the convergence of multiple problems. Obviously, just the perils to marine life and humans that toxic oil causes, not to mention dispersants, but also, as you talked about in your article in Mother Jones that I mentioned just a few minutes ago, the ocean acidification problem, which, of course, is related to climate change. You don't hear as much about that, and yet I remember being just sort of horrified when you talked about the shells, you know, of, you know, certain marine life already dissolving or dissipating because of the changing in the structure of the ocean water.
Yeah, the problem with ocean acidification is as the CO2 levels, carbon dioxide, rise in the air, the ocean becomes more saturated, taking it up, and the ocean has taken up an awful lot of our atmospheric emissions of carbon. And as a result, though, the pH of the ocean is changing, and as it becomes more acid, it is going to increasingly make it harder for every animal that builds anything out of calcium carbonate. That's whether it's a coral reef animal or an animal with a shell, lots of larval animals that have some form of shell. A lot of the fish, virtually all the marine life has a larval phase where they look very, very different from their adult animals, and many of them have sort of a shell incorporated into that phase, and it's going to be really hard for those animals in an increasingly acid ocean to be able to do that. So that's a real concern.
Julie, is that happening just at the surface waters where the temperature is noticeably warmer, or is that happening all the way down deep?
I believe that will be something that will affect the water column, although I don't know how equally distributed or how quickly it will work its way throughout the water column. And, the ocean is chemistry. It changes based on temperature and salinity, pressure and depth. So I'm sure there's going to be variation in that. I can't talk exactly to what that is at this point.
Your love of oceans began when you were a teenager, I learned, in reading the jacket on this book. Tell us what your first experiences were and why you decided to devote a lot of your working life to bringing the oceans to those of us landlocked folks.
Yeah, well, the ocean is a beautiful place. I was lucky enough to grow up close to the ocean in New England, and I spent a lot of my summers on Cape Cod. My father was a sailor. He was an Australian that grew up sailing off Tasmania in the wild Southern Ocean, really tough, rough water sailing. And he took us out and taught us how to sail, and that was exciting. And my mother also grew up in a place where the ocean was very important to her. So, and then I grew up in an era, thankfully, where I was allowed to run wild on the beach as a kid. My brothers and I were able to just run around and do what we wanted. And I developed a relationship with the sea, and that's what happens when you let kids run around on their own. They develop their own relationship, yeah, with nature. And I developed a strong one thanks to all those miles of sand I got, under my feet and churning through the waters and looking for this and that. And I've been pursuing it ever since.
Uh-huh. And so you did not suffer from nature deficit disorder, but too many American kids do, and obesity at the same time. And, of course, there is a connection.
Yeah, it's a sad connection. I would like to see parents let their kids go out more and with less adult supervision. I think, if you want to assess risk, there's a huge risk to not letting kids form a relationship with nature. And our whole planet will, suffers to some extent from people that don't have a relationship with nature. It may affect so many choices that we make in our adult lives. So, generally I'm always saying, go outside. Turn off the television. Go outside.
Turn off the computer. Turn off the cell phone. Turn off the text. With a teenage girl at home, I certainly know that obsession has really gone too far with technology. But, really is a matter of not being able to protect what we don't know and what we don't love. And one of the many interviews I've done over the years, one quote stuck with me, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the gentleman's name right now, but he said, look what we're losing with each generation, where you have the memory of running free on the beach, and I didn't grow up on the ocean, but I grew up near a creek, and some of my favorite, girlhood memories are going down to the creek and playing with the tadpoles and watching them turn into little frogs, and it was so real and tactile and tangible, and watching the different things that would change over the seasons. If you don't have that experience, you won't even know, which my daughter, other than going to camp, really doesn't have enough of that. You don't know what you're missing if you don't have it. And so with each successive generation, we're losing that memory of what's precious, what's valuable in as far as nature goes. And that's
dangerous. Yeah, it does change, that's for certain. It changes from generation to generation in our rapidly changing world. But I will say that on the positive side, even inner city kids can have a relationship with nature. It might be a tree growing in the sidewalk, It could be a very tiny neighborhood park, and that is good, and that can be enough. It can still foster an intense relationship with nature if you are allowed to have the knowledge and the relationship with that wild thing in your world. So we don't all have to get outside to to really remote wild places to foster that important love of our supportive living planet.
That's right, our life support system, and to realize that we are part of nature, of course, which
Absolutely.
Gets lost sometimes in translation.
Yeah, completely. I mean, we can't do it without all these living things to help us. So.
That's kind of a key, you know, you just kind of just said that, but isn't that the key to all this? This is our life support system. It is a selfish act to protect Mother Earth and all the many gifts we get every day and need to live on, survive
Absolutely.
On.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, in my book, Deep Blue Home, I talk a lot about the power of the world ocean. We had thought the oceans were separate beings and named them for the basins that they live in, but we now know that they're very much connected by deep currents and layers of currents that run like a huge rivers underwater. Deep, deep underwater are rivers of ocean flowing in all different directions at different speeds, and they mix and move all the waters of the world. And these waters of the world ocean are what make our planet livable. It's really been an ongoing sort of collaboration between the ocean and the atmosphere that have enabled us to have life on land. If we didn't have those two huge forces in collaboration, then we would not have life on land. So it's very important that we understand and take care and try to maintain the stability of these systems that have enabled us as a species to flourish.
You talk in your book about the world ocean and as a single body of water, but connected by three-dimensional currents that are vast encircling our globe. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's the sort of underwater rivers that I refer to. And so we do know that the world ocean is, we know that the ocean has many currents, not just the surface currents, like, for instance, the Gulf Stream, a famous, very swift ocean, surface ocean current. We also know there are very deep currents and that these often tend to be slower, they're colder, and they are transporting the water of the world ocean around in something that scientists might call the ocean conveyor or the ocean conveyor belt. And the ocean conveyor belt will take a drop of rainwater that falls in the North Atlantic, and it will cycle it through the ocean basins down, shuttle it all the way down to Antarctica, shoot it back up, and it will eventually emerge in the North Pacific perhaps 2,000 years later at the surface. It makes drops of water make these huge journeys over the course of thousands of years, and they mix the water of the ocean, and they carry with them the seeds of life and the seeds of climate. So it's extremely important. We're just still deciphering the broadest understanding of this ocean conveyor. We just recent research found a whole new current off Antarctica, very deep, very cold, and very unexpectedly fast current that no one knew was there, and certainly a very important driver of global climate.
And I recall when I was in Nashville for Al Gore's first training of the Climate Project team, one of the most, probably the most dramatic moment of the, you know, two-day training was he was talking about this conveyor belt, these currents, and he actually took off his belt, off his pants, and held it up in kind of a, you know, bell curve, and took each end of the belt and kind of jiggled it back and forth and said, you know, we can mess with the currents with a conveyor belt, you know, so much until all of a sudden it snaps. And I remember that was a very strong visual, sort of stunning moment when it kind of really depicted how Earth, you know, what we do to her can, you know, be pretty resilient until, who knows, we get to a tipping point and you know, God knows what will be unleashed. And we're fueling with Mother Nature in that way. And this conveyor belt is critical to life on Earth.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, part of what I write about in my book is I dip back into past beliefs about the ocean. So I go back to mythology and I talk about some of the great ocean gods of the past, like the Viking god Egger, who they believed lived in this great hall at the bottom of the sea, and that he was older than the gods, and he was older even than the giants who had preceded the gods, that he was a primordial force whose beginnings could not be known. And this was what the ocean signified to the Vikings. And, you know, and they traveled the ocean. They came as far as North America. We know their settlements are in Newfoundland, which is where part of the Canadian province of Newfoundland, where a big part of my book takes place. So we had this deep understanding going way back in our own history of the force and the power of the ocean. And it's something that I hope to foster in whatever way I can through my own writing to bring us back to a place where we really love this place and appreciate the services that the ocean performs that give us life.
Right, the true, and put a true value on nature, as Janine Benyus and Paul Hawken and Hunter Lovin, so many of the people I'm sure you know, and you are pointing out that this is something we should so not be taking for granted, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
So what do you hope to do with this book, Julia? I know you've written some great articles for Mother Jones, but isn't it important to really get this message out to the mainstream public, average Americans?
Yeah, and the book, you know, I've really written the book as my love story with the ocean, and I write it as a love story. It follows my own trajectory in life in a kind of a light way, but I follow my own beginnings in science. I went on to make nature documentaries for many years, and then I transitioned to writing, which is what I do now. And I wanted to just describe this love affair that has been the central core of my own life, because I know a lot of people share this. I know a lot of people are so as drawn to the ocean, love the ocean as much as I do, and I really hope to reach out even to people who don't get to the ocean very often, and I spend a fair amount of the book explaining why what happens in the ocean is important, even if you live far inland, far from a salty coastline.
Mm-hmm. And you share that love with another author, writes on the same subject, David Helvarg. You must know him.
I do, yes, I do. Yeah. He writes wonderfully. I think he has a new book out right now, too.
Yes, and I just saw him at a Blue Frontier Campaign Awards dinner, and he mentioned another one of my sheroes, and I'm sure yours as well, and that is Roz Savage.
Oh, absolutely.
Doing solo Ocean Rose to raise awareness about climate change. That woman's got more kahunas than any guy I know. And she, by the way, doesn't love the water. She's not a big swimmer. She doesn't even catch fish to eat, she said. She's amazing. You think it's all to raise awareness and to challenge herself personally, because she does have normal fears of,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible. Yeah.
It is.
She's
the more you know
amazing.
Her. Yeah, and she just keeps on, you know, outdoing herself with her exploits, and all with a purpose, with a message. So just have to mention her every possibility. And David Rothschild's effort, of course, to raise awareness about plastics in the ocean. Do you think, you know, these stories are finally getting out there in a more mainstream way, perhaps, if nothing else, because of this oil kill, this disaster still unfolding in the Gulf? People are paying more attention to our oceans. That certainly is the hope.
Yeah, I do think that there's been a big awareness now. If we can really capitalize on it and have some true action take place, I hope that's true, because I do think that people, everyone I speak to is really deeply hurt. You know, it's like a physical assault to learn these stories coming out of the Gulf and hear more and more of it every day in this seeming endless, unsolvable situation. So I do hope that this is the opportunity for us to really turn a corner and begin to re-examine how we deal with the deep ocean. How can we just be drilling out there without any effective, even remotely effective, disaster spill response? You know, how can we be allowing oil companies to go out there and just be destroying deep sea ecosystems without having assessed them at all? How do we do that?
So, and that's what we know now. They said, you know, BP and Exxon, they said they had disaster plans. The technology will fix the problem, but it doesn't matter what they say now. We now know the truth. So that's what's really changed, I think, because they would want us to believe that there was a plan in place, you know, for any eventuality, and that's clearly not the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing that this tragedy in the Gulf has done is make people really, really angry about corporate culture. And I mean, even if people were sort of simmering before, I think they're really boiling now. And I hope that that doesn't just go into fatalism and people giving up and thinking it's utterly hopeless. I mean, in all honesty, I hope it'll lead us to realize that we need to take our world back from these powers. We need to reassert control. We need our government to represent the public interest, not the corporate interest. And we need to make sure that happens. We need to take it all back from them.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, David Helvarg's new book is called Saved by the Sea. And he calls it a love story with fish. you know, if nothing else, like you say, this will cause people to look at this, and that is really what's needed. I mean, it's one thing to have, you know, environmental activists and authors, but it just hopefully will be the turning point so that we can engage all Americans in this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, In 1969, we had an oil spill off Santa Barbara, and we, some places along the U.S. coast, we said, that's it, no more offshore drilling. So California put a lid on any further drilling there. In 1989, we had the Exxon Valdez spill, and we said, whoa, wait a minute, let's take a look at tankers. Are they safe enough? Can we do anything to make it better? And we changed the regulations on what kind of ships can carry oil across the ocean. Well, this is our opportunity 20 years after that to really reexamine where are we drilling, what are the frontiers of technology, we've pushed an envelope and broke it, and we have to take a more stringent and realistic assessment now without believing everything that industry tells us. And we need to get lobbyists out of our political decision-making if we can. I realize that's asking a lot, but we really do. I mean, the price is way too high for dealing with this the way we have dealt with it up until now.
So you must be pleased and slightly encouraged by the newly imposed moratorium on deep water drilling.
I think it's important. I'm still alarmed that there's still deep water drilling going on elsewhere in the world, and nobody else, as far as I know, has imposed a moratorium. So, I covered a story last year that barely made it into the media whatsoever, but a similar oil spill off Australia in the Timor Sea. It was more than 100 miles from land. It was far from sight. It was deep. And it took them 5 relief wells before they could cap that thing, and something like 74 days. So a similar situation, vast amounts of oil spilled. No one will ever know the real amount. And again, in a very important ecosystem out there, and we'll really never know the effects of it. So, that was a sneak preview. We ignored it.
Uh-huh.
And where else in the world is this still going on? And we need to really examine clearly the costs, of true costs of oil.
And that's why Ricky Ott's voice is also so critical, because she has been studying the long-term impacts of the Exxon Valdez disaster, 21 years later, on, not only the fishing and tourism industry, but the human health impact and the marine life. She's a marine toxicologist, so this is what she does as a fisherman, as she calls herself, and also author and activist. And she's been down in the Gulf, of course, for now most of the time, I think, that the kill, can't even call it a spill, has been taking place. And it's so great to see her on CNN, on Larry King, on Anderson Cooper's show, talking about how, the impact of this is going to go on for decades. And really now we know, and then what the amount of oil that flowed from the Exxon Valdez accident is being repeated every 4 days in the Gulf.
Absolutely. We know from another study there was a spill in Buzzards Bay off Cape Cod more than 40 years ago, and that's been actually quite intensively studied ever since. One of the longest term ongoing looks at what happens to that oil over time, and it's still affecting the food web in those waters. And just recently a new study came out showing that the invertebrates like crabs and things, when they live in the area still affected by that spill of 41 years ago, they are not the same as crabs anywhere else. They react differently. Their reflexes are slower. In fact, according to this researcher, they appear to be drunk. That's how much they're still affected all these years later.
Wow.
So once this stuff's in the system, it's incredibly hard to get out. And I mean, what's happened in the Gulf right now in terms of using dispersants is just guaranteed that we'll never get it out. That's the really disheartening part.
Julie, we just have about 4 minutes left. I'd love for you to spend just maybe 2 minutes on one anecdote from your just recent trip down there, something that really stuck out in your mind, had an impact, and then just tell us about your book tour, and then we'll have to wrap up.
Sure. I loved being in the Gulf. I've been there before. It's one of my favorite places, and it's incredibly vital and alive despite the stressors. So it's very sad to see these waters oiled, these beaches oiled, these marshes oiled. I saw dolphins swimming in oil. I saw them fishing in oil. And I knew enough about that population of dolphins to know that they had nowhere else to go. Their territorial boundaries were such that they did not leave this one particular bay. That was terrible. And, hermit crabs fleeing the water, their shells coated with this chocolate syrup of oil, running up the beach and leaving these little oily foot marks of themselves trying to get out and then being glued to the sand by oil. So these are really heartbreaking things. But in my book, I also talk about a lot of the wonders and the beauty of the ocean. I said it's a love story, and if we love it enough, hopefully we will save it. And I will be reading this evening at Book Passage in Corte Madera at 7 o'clock, and I'll be doing a reading also Friday night in Davis, California, at the Avid Reader at 7:30. So I hope to see some people there.
Wonderful. And tell us also about an article you have coming up soon in Mother Jones, if people can't get the book right away.
Yeah, the article will be out in the next issue of Mother Jones, probably be on the newsstands in about mid-August, and it's about my time down on the oil spill and the effects in the deep ocean, which we're not taking a lot of look at, but I happen to be working on a story about the deep ocean when the spill happened in it, so I was able to incorporate, merge the two, and now I have a story about what the effects of oil might be there.
Wow, and in fact, that is, of course, another distinction between Exxon Valdez and this is, you know, that was on the surface. This is down so deep, and nobody, even Ricky Ott, knows, can predict, you know, the impact, long-term impact of those deep plumes of oil as they go through the currents and wash ashore in places beyond the Gulf Coast. And wouldn't it be some kind of environmental justice for that oil to eventually, you know, wash up on England's shore where BP is based? Not that anybody wants it to travel that far, but that's the power of these currents, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the computer modeling shows this stuff definitely coming out of the Gulf, shooting up the Gulf Stream in that very fast surface current and, you know, being sort of spewed out across the North Atlantic towards Europe. I don't wish that on anyone because, you know, it's going to be terrible as it goes. If we don't cap it, it's inevitable. Hopefully we can. Hopefully they can get this thing stopped.
Are you planning to go back to the Gulf Coast region, or where is home base for you?
I'm in Northern California, and I probably will go back. I am on a book tour at the moment, so it's a little hard for me to get away.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah,
well,
as soon as I can.
I want to wish you luck on your book tour. I plan to mention this book to anyone who is at all concerned about what's going on in the Gulf, and that's just about everybody I know at this point. So there are things people can do to educate themselves, read about it, learn about it, and fall in love with it, as you have, as David Helvark has, as so many people have, but really important to communicate that that love affair so that more of us can understand, you know, what's at stake and what we can do about it.
Yeah.
And mostly let our legislators know that this is a priority, you know, climate change legislation, and it's all connected, of course, what happens in our oceans and our oil and energy policies. I think that's really important to emphasize, as you do so well, the connections here.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Betsy.
Thank you, Julia. We are out of time. That does it for this edition of The Green Front. I wish you a great green week, and get out there and learn what you can about what we can do to turn this around. It's up to us. It's in our hands.